Thank you very much, Professor Vandenhoek.
Our third speaker is Professor Vivas, Professor of Moral and Intellectual Philosophy at Northwestern University.
When Dean Wiggins offered me the honor of participating in this panel, he suggested that I speak on Marcuse. But I decided that in the few minutes that I had, I would not be able to give those of you who have not read him, an adequate idea of the coarseness of his thought and the absurdity of his condemnations of the nation to which he is so deeply in debt. I thought it would be preferable if I spoke to you about my own academic experience. And I for 42. The presentation I shall make will be autobiographical. There would be no point in pretending that I could present an objective report based on the methodological devices of the sociologist. But while I speak out of my own experience, I do have something of a right to an opinion on American universities. The right comes not only from the long stretch that I have done in four of them, but also from the intimate acquaintance with a large number of institutions in which I have served for shorter periods. I would warn you, however, that all I can do is to review the facts that are well known in and out of the university world and suggest some reasons that may help account for the condition at which the universities have arrived. The thorough and detailed analysis of this topic, of course, would call for a long, long paper, and it's not proper here. Before proceeding, it is necessary to state emphatically that my remarks are not intended to apply to each and every member of the academic community. The fact that this society is composed of many academics, and the fact that these meetings, regents, presidents, as well as professors, have contributed, shows that there is a saving remnant. But you all know that the large majority of the staff of the colleges of arts and sciences, at least, today are leftists. I suspect that the overwhelming leftist orthodoxy has spread to in varying degrees of success to professional schools in which leftist views, until recently, were not favorably received. Schools of medicine, engineering, business, and the law. But this is a subject on which I can only express an uninformed fear. What I would like to leave you with no doubt about, let me iterate, is that I am as aware as anyone of the fact that there are exceptions. Here, heresy manages to survive in the universities in spite of the embattled intolerance of the liberal to any opinion right of center. How heresy manages to survive will be an interesting and glorious page in the history of our contemporary academic dark ages. The first step in the review is a hasty survey of the basic principles and ideas that used to govern the universities of the late 20s when I began teaching. At that time, most teachers would have told you that their job was to transmit the fundamental values of our civilization to the future and to add to that heritage along the lines in harmony with it. The values of which the teachers were the keepers, they would have added, like delicate living organisms, were easily destroyed if not handled with care and piety. Piety in the Roman sense, in the sense of gratitude and reverence for those values that were taken to be at the center of our being. They would have added that they were conscious of the great responsibility and the privilege conferred on them by their community. To transmit these values, unimpaired and undiminished, it was necessary to keep them alive in a very special sense. They have to be interpreted and reinterpreted constantly. By this process, which goes under the name of a generic name of research, the teacher added according to his capacity to the heritage of which he was the guardian and which it was his duty and privilege to pass on to the future. The need for a constant reinterpretation of our heritage as the need for the constant reinterpretation was and is still obvious. It is only by interpreting and reinterpreting our heritage as our conditions change that its values can be kept alive. Put it on tape, so to speak, and play the tape over and over, and the values of our heritage become blurred and become a threat to humane existence. Interpretation and reinterpretation discover meanings in our heritage that our ancestors missed and quietly drops values once taken to be essential that are no longer so. Research has often been defended on the grounds that it is needed to keep the teacher alive and that it constitutes an addition to our knowledge. But it is seldom mentioned that its most indispensable function was the keeping of our great values alive and thus being the central agency in the historical continuity of our society. This factor we shall have to recall when we come to speak of the conditions in which the universities find themselves today. The teachers of the late 20s might have put in second place another function, but they would have been eager to indicate this task was no less important than the other. They were responsible for the development of character in their students. This conception of the university may not seem to include the scientific department, for as I have sketched it, the idea of the university was essentially conservative and seemed to be based on the role played by the humanities rather than by the sciences. What role did the sciences then play? The sciences, of course, enlarged our knowledge, but because of their nature, they also made an important contribution. They were responsible for the dynamics of our civilization, a civilization that from its very beginning, with the exception of a few periods of regression, has always been in motion. That they could get out of hand and push us too fast and push us towards destruction was something that in the late 20s, no man could have conceived. How well did the universities and colleges do the job in those days? They did it, as one can expect, from human institutions, as well as institutions do their job. Some well, some better, and some poorly. The Wisconsin to which I returned in 1926 was a good university, but there were other good universities and colleges in the country. The academic animal is very much the same everywhere as I have been, but he's also very much like his fellow beings outside the academy. Our institutions of higher learning were staffed by human beings, which is to say that some of its members were developed, devoted, and excellent scholars and teachers, and some were promoters, some utter fakes, and some were clowns. There were a few petty power maniacs, inwardly insecure and having very good reason for their insecurity. And there was, of course, the normal contingent of prima donnas that is to be found in any group. But whatever their virtues or their faults, the great majority of academics were doing their work with considerable success. And the majority were gentlemen and scholars. If you examine the phrase, you will perceive that it is somewhat redundant. For a man can be a gentleman and know little beyond horse and female flesh. But a scholar who was not a gentleman was in those days inconceivable. I could continue to sing the praises of the universities and colleges of the 20s for a number of pages, but it is time I turned over to the review of what today universities and colleges take their function to be. Those of you acquainted with the state of our universities today have already made in your minds the contrast, which I am about to sketch. The most obvious contrast is that in the late 20s, the majority of our faculties were right of center, and very few left of it. I cannot go into the history of the change, except to say that it seems to have come suddenly after the war. But in fact, my generation prepared the way for the 30s, the way in the 30s for the 40s. I'm sorry to say that I was among those who did his bit in the preparing. Our factors, other factors, of course, would have to be mentioned in a complete analysis of the change. The fact itself cannot be doubted. With the change in political beliefs of our academic staff, as one could have predicted, came a complete redefinition of the function of our academic institutions. And it is from this new idea of the university that today flows the most serious threat to our society. Contemporary academic orthodoxy no longer conceives the task of the universities to be the addition of knowledge that is of value in itself and the preservation and addition of those other values to our heritage along the lines of our development. It proclaims the task to be the application of what knowledge or pseudo-knowledge comes to hand, so long as that knowledge advances their ideological prejudices, which are, of course, also called knowledge. Questions that ought to be kept open are closed if the closing of them enables the orthodoxy to push our society farther towards the socialist millennium. You hear young sociologists, social scientists, political scientists, anthropologists, and even psychologists. Let me stop and say that I have no one in mind that is present in this audience. You hear young sociologists with lots of hair on their jaws but no evidence of wisdom in their craniums undertake to lead us to the millennium. Of course, depth psychologists can be expected to be experts, but when behaviorists undertake to save us, the act would be funny if it were not so dangerous. I have long ago thought that these people are mad with the lust of power. They could convince us that the world they want is better, the world they want to bring about will be better than ours if they could prove to us that tyranny is better than freedom, that bigotry and fanaticism is better than the effort, not always successful, to achieve an ironic attitude in order to look on the mysteries of nature and the irrationalities of man as objectively as possible. The majority of our academic men today pay lip service to democracy. And I would not put it in doubt that they actually believe what they say. But we should not be deceived by their protestations. They are Leninists, although only a few of them know that they are. For the heart of Leninism is the idea that a small band of professional revolutionists knows better than the masses themselves what the masses ought to want. This is not only Marcuse's position, as you would expect. It is the position of all of our experts. And since the experts acquired their expert superiority in colleges and universities, where they or their parents acquired their liberalism, it is in these institutions that it is to these institutions that we must trace the concealed Leninism of our bureaucracy. Long before I heard of one-dimensional man, I asked a professor of educational psychology, then at Teachers College, whether he would submit a reform that he was proposing to a popular referendum. I got the answer I expected. He would do no such thing. Let me tell you in all earnestness that this attitude is typical of the liberal who, of course, considers himself an expert, particularly an expert on politics and social problems. The liberal is only a Democrat when he is forced to be one. He has always tried to shove down the throats of the majority anything he, in his superior knowledge, decides is good, even if the majority hates it. Their latest feat, I need not remind you, is to shove down the throat of the majority what the majority considers garbage in literature or in the movies. I'm not saying, of course, that the majority is always right and the liberals are always wrong. I'm simply saying that the latter are Leninists. It would be irresponsible on our part to believe that they have no chance of success. The success they are having proves the contrary. In any case, they have everything going for them. Our admiration of science, our inability to distinguish true science from pseudoscience and from scientism and ideology, our helplessness before the trend of the present, our helplessness towards a secularist hedonism that liberals espouse and that we cannot altogether reject. The historical trend is towards a total technological society, and I use the word in a loose sense of the term, which aids and abets the kind of despotism liberal professors are trying eagerly to bring about. Let me dwell for a while longer on this important point. Liberal experts base their claim to lead us towards their future on their superior scientific knowledge. They choose to forget, of course, that it is not in the nature of science to define goals or ideals. This must be defined by men and by whatever methods are used to arrive at the definition. Ultimately, the decision depends on the concept of the nature of the universe and of man's relation to it that is held by the definer. When you dwell on this matter critically, you come upon a shocking and at first an unbelievable fact. These men make no claim to the possession of a virtue that men have always, as far back as our knowledge of man goes, wisdom. Along with courage and not many other virtues, wisdom has always been held in the highest esteem by men. But the majority of the liberal professoriate today has no use for it. And the hard-nosed positivists openly laugh at it. Wisdom is no longer needed. To combat the harshness of nature, you bring in technology. To get along with our neighbors, you get rid of your paranoia. They are not out to bury us. What they want to do for us is what they did for the Hungarians and the Czechs. They want to give us freedom and happiness. I have time to mention in passing only a matter that is of the greatest importance and that I have not seen discussed in the numerous articles on the universities that I have read of recent. By turning away from the observation of values to the drawing of plans for the brave new world, the nature of research and its value and the academic order of rank has been somewhat altered. Research is valuable if it is relevant. And I hardly need to tell you what relevance means. Van der Hagen told you anyhow. This would put the social scientist on the top of the pyramid if it were not for his ineradicable inferiority complex, because the product of his research is not as good as that of the social of the hard scientist. The hard scientists have lost some of the prestige. Ever since one of them announced to the world that they had discovered sin, he did not mean that he had lied about his past, of course. They are not too happy, particularly since some of them are part of the military-industrial complex, as it is called, and therefore are responsible for the children that we are burning in Vietnam. Part of the results of the changed complex conception of the function I would consider pathetic if I did not find it amusing. The men in the humanities, remember, they call themselves humanists, of course, have been pushed to the back of the stage, and for all the asseverations they make about the need there is of them, they know themselves to be men without a function in the activist society of the university. The old ears made two serious mistakes, one of commission and the other of omission. But you can't expect the old ears to wake up to the seriousness of their mistakes. Not always clear about what they were up to, they accepted the primacy of social action, and they failed to provide themselves with an acceptable apologia for their professional activities. A man in the humanities who accepts the primacy of social action must sooner or later ask himself what is the value of his professional activity. If he's serious, he cannot remain content forever cheering on the sidewalk as the parade marches by. This need not have been the case had they had been a clear and well thought out idea of the indispensable value of their professional concerns in the creation of a civilized social body. But the liberal mind cannot forge the needed apologia. Aristocratic societies need no such apologia. And that's the reason that the old song and dance you find in writers on theory of art until today did not need to do a good job and in order to get by. The communists do not need such an apologia. They may have a little trouble with some of their artists, but they have ample means for keeping the majority in line. But in our world, particularly since the memory of the catastrophe of the proletarian art of the 30s has not faded yet, the men in the humanities have no answer to give to any of the young nihilists who ask them, what are they good for? Another consequence of the turn has gone by unnoticed. There are as many explanations of the student misconduct of recent years, both abroad and among us, as there are articles on the subject. But, to my knowledge, one explanation has not been offered. And that is that the riots in the West, and I'm speaking only in the West, about the West, are the natural and long overdue consequence of the liberal ethos with which our students have been ruthlessly indoctrinated. As stated in its naked simplicity, the liberal argument for activism runs as follows, and of course you know it. We ought to be building a good world for the future. The present world is wrong. Evil is the result of the environment. Man is innately good. And the rest of the argle-bargle of the liberal old boys. The punks listen to these cardiac hemophiliacs and arrive at two conclusions. The first is that the old boys are right. The world stinks. It could not be worse than it is. The second is that the old boys do not really mean what they say. If they did really mean what they say, they would go out with the kids. I take it that's what they call themselves. Telling the pigs what they do to their mothers and throwing human ordure at them. I need not tell you that they use a shorter word. The kids want change, and they want it now. It's no wonder, therefore, that a poor liberal professor of California who had the tires of his car slashed is in a coma of bewilderment. Too bad, man, but you will never believe that you brought it on yourself. The disappearance of the word wisdom from the vocabulary of the scientific liberals is concomitant with another change that has been taking place in our universities and that seems by now, if my data is representative, to have gone nearly as far as it can. The university no longer feels its responsibility to forge character. I have evidence that some administrations openly reject the idea that that is their responsibility. I have long harbored a suspicion that the universities of old were not as successful as they thought they were in building character. But they made some effort, and the effort was not altogether wasted. And they did maintain decorum, a virtue that today is noticeable for its absence in the academic world. If our academic liberals, our liberal experts today, have no use for wisdom, how do they discover the goals they want us to pursue? A satisfactory answer to this question would call, not for a long paper, but a seminar of several sessions. For at this point, we come to the divide. On the one hand, we have the revolutionists. On the other, those who would conserve while improving. The revolutionists appeal to the 18th century notion of reason and the blueprints that are the creation of men in utopian reaction to the genuine and the imagined evils of our world. On the other hand, you have men like Burke who appeal to the knowledge and the prudence of the past. What we have inherited is the product of wisdom as well as of iniquity and irrationality. But one thing is totally impossible, and that is to wreck the system and start anew. The revolutionist who rejects wisdom because he thinks he has something better. The revolutionist rejects wisdom because he thinks he has something better. Wisdom rooted in the past carries ever into the present too many of the old evils to be acceptable. It is a mask to keep the ancient iniquities alive. It is at this point that Herbert Marcuse becomes relevant. I have read no one who has done what he has done. We have arrived at a point at which we are in the human development by a very slow climb on a difficult ladder. I know of no one who has kicked the ladder from under him with the ferocity with which Marcuse has done it. His program, as Santayana would say, reduced to its fighting weight, is this. First, wreck the joint. He says he does not want the universities wrecked. But here his followers are more intelligent than he is. If we're going to wreck the joint, we must first wreck the universities for at least two reasons. They are the most vulnerable part of our military-industrial complex, and they are the essential institution that keeps our system going. But it is not the result arrived at by Marcuse or his followers that I am so much interested in as in the way they reached it. Briefly stated, it is in this way. First, Marcuse appeals to reason. Unbelievable. The reason he appeals to is the 18th century pre-1789 reason of the French revolutionists. That reason has been cured in the Hegelian warehouse and processed by Marx. But reason is not enough. Without argument, he posits the end of man to be an unfettered hedonism. And this is where his quarrel with Freud comes in. Freud would have it that our civilization involves discontent and repression, and that it involves these things inevitably. Marcuse argues that it does not. Repression and the domination that it brings with it is the result of scarcity. But we today have the means to produce in order to give each according to his need, and each not here, but everywhere. This would enable us all to regress, and this is his term, regress, to the condition we were in before the tyranny of the genital did away with our polymorphic sensuality. Norman O. Brown calls it polymorphic perversity. Having recovered our polymorphic sensuality or perversity, we could develop into free or full human beings, men who play and display all day with a short time off for work. But he's emphatic on making you see work, not labor, which is what we do today in our slavery. If you ask Marcuse what he will put in place of the world he wants to destroy, he tells you that his theory, and I'm quoting, possesses no concepts which would bridge the gap between the present and the future. Holding no promise, he continues, and showing no success, it remains negative. This is his quotation. When man shall regress from the tyranny of the genital, a new morality will come into being. And if you ask him what it is, he says he cannot tell you because it hasn't yet come into being. That's the only place where I have found out that Marcuse is a real empiricist. In the meantime, it has by now become fairly well known that he advocates what he calls repressive tolerance. This double talk means that he tolerates those of the left and represses those of the right. Marcuse's system is more complex, and out of it, he extracts criteria to reject the whole of our world. Nothing at all is acceptable, although it is, although in his last book, which I have not yet had time to study, he seems to be less gloomy. The university riots in Europe and in the United States have let a ray of hope in his dark heart. But whether Marcuse has become less gloomy because of the riots or not, what we must not miss is that he has seen with full clarity the meaning of the liberal ideal, and he has formulated it without concealment. There is considerably more to be said. You can easily imagine what happens to the ideals of scholarship and those of liberal when the liberal activists engage in research. And you do not have to reckon long to see how in about 40 years, the self-selective process of recruiting and undergraduate and graduate indoctrination has made of the professoriate a cohesive, homogeneous body controlled internally by powerfully orthodoxy that brooks no dissent. What's more difficult to appreciate, unless one has observed it from within, is how both the intellectual life of the universities and the daily intercourse in the academy has coarsened. The history of the academic world during the years I have spent in it is a very sad history. It is only when you live with the academic intellectuals who claim the right to lead social change that you are in a position to measure the sadness and the horror of the threat. But it would be a serious error if we forgot that history includes also accounts of triumphs such as men have never before achieved, particularly in the field of science. It also includes, let us not forget it, it also includes an account of the enlargement of our moral awareness, and as a result, an account of the effect to put into practice of our, an account of the enlargement of our moral awareness, and as a result, an account of the effort to put into practice the insights derived from our awareness. Liberals today who claim a corner on the goodwill towards men are wrong. Men of the right also want a good and a humane world. We differ from the dominant liberal orthodoxy because we have seen the horror of the utopias they can create. The despotism, the brutality, the genocides that the revolutionists have brought about. Because of the record, they are wrong. They are wrong because they have a false notion of man, and because they have no genuine sense of human dignity and nothing but the lowest ideal of his destiny. But they are wrong, worst of all, because they do not know what they are doing. Remember what Lenin said when he and his followers would get ready to hang us, we would bring around the rope. They are wrong because they don't know what they're doing. What we are doing is making the rope with which Lenin's descendants are going to hang us.